Welcome to a series of podcasts brought to you by the Yale Law School. Professor Heather Gerken specializes in election law, constitutional law, and civil procedure at the Yale Law School. She is one of the country's leading experts on voting rights and election law, the role of groups in a democratic process, and the relationship between diversity and democracy. The following is Professor Gerken's inaugural lecture as the J. Skelly Wright Professor of Law, titled Federalism All the Way Down. This lecture was delivered at the Yale Law School on March 8, 2010.
I am so honored to be here. I'm actually almost nervous, and I never get nervous about public speaking. It's nice to see all familiar faces here. So I'm incredibly honored to have this chair. To have my name associated in any way with such a great judge is something that's very hard to live up to. My dad, who's sitting right here, has always reminded me that when you measure success, the measure is how far someone has come, not how far they've gone. And by that measure alone, Skelly Wright was a pretty remarkable person. He was a Knight student in law school, and then he went and became a D.C. Circuit judge. And that's just part of the story. What made him so remarkable is that he was willing to fight his own community on the question of racial segregation. One of his clerks actually said that the Klan burned a cross so often on his lawn that when he and his wife would go out to dinner, he'd just casually say to his son, "You know, son, just don't worry about it. If it gets close enough, call the fire department." It was such a usual routine for them. So no one could live up to that name. I'm honored that you've given me a chance to try. And as to all of this, I just can't tell you how much it means to me to see all of you here. I feel a little bit like, you know, a New Englander does about religion. We don't talk about it. The reason we don't talk about it is we worry that if we choose the wrong words, we'll somehow sully it. So I will just say thank you. And I also wanted to say thanks to the invisible people who make things like this happen, to Mike Thompson and Beth Barnes, to Robert and Riva, who've given up yet another night with one another to be here. When I was at Brett's wonderful shindig last week, I realized watching Judith and, as far as I could tell, everyone in the law school pull that together. It was really lovely, and I think because the staff here does things so professionally, we tend not to see it because it just runs so smoothly, so I just wanted to thank them for that. So this paper began actually the first time that I met the Yale Law School. I was an assistant professor at Harvard, and I had come for the Yale-Stanford Junior Faculty Forum, and the legendary Kathleen Sullivan and Bruce Ackerman were commenting on my paper. And Bruce got up, those of you familiar with Bruce, and he just kept talking about about federalism. I wasn't quite sure if I had fully grasped the brilliance of his insights. And so when I got up to respond, I had lots of things to say to Kathleen Sullivan, but to Bruce I said only, "You're right, Bruce, there's more to say about federalism." So here's a little bit on federalism. "We make much of our federalism. We devote thousands of pages to its virtues and vices. The Supreme Court routinely crafts doctrines to federalism's ends, and we see paeans to federalism appear routinely in the US reports. But federalism also has its critics. Even some sympathetic to federalism mourn its narrow focus on states and sovereignty, pointing out that neither plays the role that they once did in our constitutional scheme. Critics argue that the functional accounts we invoke for caring about states apply as well, if not better, to cities. They observe that the formal protections sovereignty affords are necessary for achieving federalism's ends. And of course, standing outside of these debates are the nationalists, who think that whatever its meets and bounds, federalism's benefits don't outweigh the national interest in uniformity. The problem, in my view, is not that we haven't taken these critics too seriously. The problem is that we haven't taken them seriously enough. Critics have urged us to move beyond states, but we have only looked to cities, the institutions that most closely resemble states in their political reform, rather than applying federalism's core insights all the way down to school committees and zoning commissions, prosecutors' offices, and juries. Critics have urged us to move beyond sovereignty, and yet even when we have done so, we still cling to a sovereigntist vision of power, the idea of presiding over one's own empire, rather than being part of someone else's. As a result, we haven't just missed interesting issues associated with minority rule at the state and local level, ideas that are in some senses internal to the theory. We've missed the arguments that would help us make the nationalist case for federalism. We should take the invitation to imagine federalism more seriously than the critics who have issued it. Now, so I don't want you to equate my willingness to listen to federalism's critics as a skepticism about federalism, because this is a project of recovery, not rejection. Many of federalism's critics think the notion is quaint and outdated, something that we should simply assign to the proverbial dustbin of history. But that is a mistake. A narrow focus on sovereign states has pushed us away of an account of federalism suited to the 21st century. But the core insight of federalism, that government sometimes benefits when national minorities constitute local majorities, that still has resonance despite the many changes our nation has undergone. Now, a talk is not enough time to develop a full account of federalism all the way down, even for someone who talks as quickly as I do. So all I'm hoping to do today is to convince you that this project involves a good deal more than the witless application of federalism theory to local institutions. Instead, I think it raises new questions that are at least as interesting as those that currently preoccupy the field. So here I'm going to give you a sampling of the ideas that I think materialize if we reimagine federalism for the 21st century. Now, it would be more sensible to talk about one simple idea. My father always teaches me that about speeches. But I am right now in the midst of a full-blown academic obsession. I've been writing this paper for about 6 weeks. I daydream about these questions. I dream about these questions. I can barely have a conversation with my husband when I get home from writing. And so I can't resist the obsessive impulse to tell you about at least some of them. So don't worry, I won't keep you here for hours. Some of the ideas I'll just take out for a quick little spin. And I'll spend a fair bit of time on one of them, which is the idea that federalism ought to be thought of as a source of racial empowerment, not just racial oppression. So let me just start with a few of the intellectual payoffs that come when we move federalism beyond states, down to local and sublocal institutions. To me, this move would push us toward a less domain-centered vision of the local and a more domain-centered vision of the states. And for those of you who haven't been around long enough to understand Yale speak, the scholarly world is divided between lumpers and splitters, those who see connections across areas and those who think that what matters is contextual differences. So localism is an area that has been dominated by splitters, and federalism is an area that's been dominated by lumpers. And that seems like a mistake on both counts. So first, let me talk a little bit about introducing a little bit of lumping to the local. Thus far, almost all of the work exploring the values associated with minority rule has been about states, with some work done on local institutions that most resemble states, that is, cities, which, like states, are sites of general jurisdiction and which are the only institution that can claim anything akin to sovereignty. But we generally don't imagine special purpose institutions like juries or school committees or zoning commissions as falling into the same category, let alone have an affirmative account of the role they might collectively play in a larger democratic scheme. As a result, those who are interested in broad gauge institutional design questions surrounding minority governance tend to write about states or cities, leaving the study of these other institutions for people who specialize in the subject area. Education law scholars write about school committees, civil procedure and criminal procedure scholars write about juries, and so on. When these scholars write about institutional design, their focus is perfectly naturally to improve policymaking in a given area, good education policy, sensible verdicts, rather than to create a well-functioning democratic scheme. Now, my guess is that one of the reasons why federalism scholars have not thought so much about these local institutions is that they are so varied. Federalism focuses on states, and that seems perfectly sensible because it is one kind of institution, not many. The real problem with this apples-to-apples justification, though, is not just a point that is well known in the literature, that states vary so dramatically in size and influence that we can really see no resemblance between California and Montana. The real problem is that states contain multitudes. In fact, states contain precisely the multitudes that would be the object of federalism all the way down. When the state interacts with the federal government, it may be interacting with its legislatures, its cities, its prosecutors, its juries, its school committees, even its local sheriffs. If diversity is a problem for federalism all the way down, then it's a problem for federalism as well. Now, none of this is to say that there aren't differences between these governance sites. Juries are different from school committees. City councils are different from prosecutors' offices. The question is simply whether these differences are so stark that it precludes any effort to discuss the similarities among them. And I think there's at least one data point for suggesting that the differences aren't that stark. Many of the functional accounts federalism scholars have given us for paying attention to states have already been applied all the way down. So why not go whole hog? Why not cast juries and school committees as sites of democratic contestation, just as we do with states? Why not imagine cities and zoning commissions as producing not just local policies, but national goods, just as we do with states? So let me give you an example, one from an area where scholars, particularly our own Akhil Amar, have already begun to envision a local institution playing a similar role to states. An example is juries. Imagine we took the plunge and cast juries not just as institutions that render verdicts, but as sources of democratic feedback, returning to the jury's historical roots. The conventional account of juries as verdict generators pushes us to think that juries should be statistical mirrors of the community from which they are drawn. We view variation in a jury's membership as a bug, not a feature, precisely because we think that the job of the jury is to provide consistent applications of the law across cases. But what if we thought of juries as something akin to state legislatures, decision makers in a larger national system? We would suddenly have a reason to value variation in the composition of juries, because it would give us a more nuanced and textured vision of what the people think. Just as we think that variation in state legislatures is a democratic plus, so too with juries. Indeed, if states and juries were understood to play a similar democratic role, we might even imagine judicial practice changing. So consider, for instance, what courts typically do when they evaluate whether a particular punishment is cruel and unusual. They engage in nose counting. They tote up the decisions of state legislatures to see where the people stand. We could, of course, do the same with juries. Juries' decisions would give us a more fine-grained read on what the people think. It might even give us a more useful sense of what they think. So let's take the death penalty as an example. Most state legislatures continue to endorse the death penalty. And local prosecutors and juries, meanwhile, are moving away from it. As a result, despite little change in formal state support for the practice, the number of executions has declined dramatically. And you might think that fact ought to matter. Locally elected prosecutors, of course, are facing the costs associated with the death penalty in a much more concrete form than state legislators. And when juries decide whether to administer the death penalty, they have to do so when neither the defendant nor the victim is a mere cipher. They can thus offer us a view on what the people think that is usefully different from legislative practice. We take another widely accepted practices regarding juries. We exclude jurors who cannot apply the death penalty from the jury. And it is a perfectly sensible rule if we simply imagine juries as applying the law and giving us consistent verdicts. But if we imagine juries as democratic sites, as part of the lawmaking process, even as sites of resistance, then the practice seems a little bit odd. It would be as if we excluded state legislators because of their views on the death penalty. Now, I don't want to make the ridiculous claim here. I often make ridiculous claims, but this is not one. I don't want to make the ridiculous claim that recasting the jury in this fashion would trump all other arguments. There are obviously very good arguments on the other side about why consistency in verdicts matters quite a lot. But we know those arguments, and we don't have a full account of their competitors. We might weigh things differently if they did. After all, we accept quite a lot of variation at the state level in the criminal justice system, precisely because we value the benefits of federalism. At the very least, we might be able to make some headway on what I think are easier questions, like the nose counting problem. Now, just as a reimagined federalism might move us to a less domain-centered account of local institutions like juries, so too it might move us to a more domain-centered account of federal-state interactions, making room for splitters in a field that has long been dominated by lumpers. A lot of federalism scholarship treats states abstractly, as an institutional it rather than an institutional they. But as I noted just a few seconds ago, federal-state interactions take place in a variety of sites, within bureaucratic, representative, or participatory structures, in sites of general jurisdiction, and in single-purpose institutions. Federalism theory has not been sensitive enough to this fact. For instance, scholars have not thought hard enough about the fact that lots of federal-state interactions take place where state bureaucrats administer federal programs. Recently, scholars in the administrative context have been interested in introducing more democratic engagement and debate within federal agencies. Although I look at Jerry and I think it's probably been forever that they've been interested in introducing more democratic debate. But they have not connected that debate to federalism. A less domain-centered account of states would suggest us that we should be pushed there, that one natural strategy for fostering debate in administrative agencies would be to introduce a dynamic completely familiar to federalism scholars into the fourth branch by embedding bureaucrats who are at least partially beholden to state constituencies. We might create opportunities for dissent and debate as bureaucrats with different perspectives, or at least a different power base, interact within the system. Now, just as moving beyond states would help us retool federalism, so too with sovereignty. Lots of scholars have urged us to abandon the notion that states require formal protections from federal interference. They argue that we don't need the de jure protection afforded by sovereignty because states already enjoy de facto autonomy because of politics, tradition, even inertia. But even those scholars who challenge the sovereigntist account still understand power as the sovereigntists do, as the power to preside over one's own empire, for states to control their policies as if you could delineate that terrain. Taking the invitation to move beyond sovereignty seriously would push us to think about vertical checks on federal power in the same dichotomous fashion that we do with horizontal checks. So as I've taught what seems like my entire con law class in here, at least since Madison, we have had two competing accounts of how to check a government horizontally. The first is the separation of powers, which depends on autonomy and independence, the requirement that everyone swims in his own lane. The second is checks and balances, which depends on integration and interdependence. For federalism, in contrast, we have a fully theorized account of the autonomy model, but we don't even have a name for its institutional alternative. An alternative to the sovereignty model does exist. It's one that closely matches the checks and balances model and fits pretty naturally with the local institutions that are the objects of federalism all the way down, and that's the administrative model. Administrative power is generally not defined as presiding over one's own empire. Few think bureaucrats are wielding their own authority. Everyone knows the power is Congress's or the president's. The power of the administrative agency is not the power of the sovereign, it is the power of the servant. And real-world practice suggests that the power of the servants can be quite formidable. The administrative model is also a natural fit for much of federalism and localism. After all, most federal-state interactions take place in those areas where states and federal government regulate together, even where states administer federal programs. And the model seems like an even better fit to me for local institutions. Indeed, you sort of wonder why it isn't the dominant model for talking about localism, given the localist mantra that local institutions are entirely the creatures of the state. The power of the servant, like the checks and balances model, turns not on separation and independence, but on integration and interdependence. The system works not because every governmental actor hews to its own policy-making realm, swims in his own lane, but because institutions are messily and sometimes haphazardly integrated, and thus depend on one another to get anything done. School committees wield power not because they preside over their own empires, but because the state legislatures need them to administer school policy. States and local officials administering federal law can edit the law that they lack the power to authorize precisely because they are inside the system, not outside of it. And so here's another lesson of federalism all the way down. We have an account of the power of the sovereign. What we need is an account of the power of the servant. So what I want to do now is turn away from the accounts, which are in some senses internal to the theory, and move to the nationalist concerns. And here again, I think there's more to say. Federalism scholars have already made many arguments designed to appeal to national interests, but they haven't had all that much to say to two recurring arguments against federalism, although here I'll note again that Akhil is one of the exceptions. So the first is the fear of parochialism, the view that local power is a threat to minority rights. And the second is a worry about what a nationalist might analogize to as the principal agent problem, the worry that state decisions that fly in the face of deeply held national norms will be insulated from reversal. So I'm going to spend most of my time on the first, but I'll have a few words on the second at the end. So let me just talk a little bit about what I think is the biggest worry of nationalists. It's the fear that federalism is an institutional design strategy that results in the oppression of minorities. Consistent with this fear, scholars of federalism and scholars of the First and 14th Amendment haven't actually had much to say to one another. And I guess that's not so surprising, because racial minorities and dissenters are usually too small to control at the state level. But they are populous enough to control at the local level. And so here I want to argue that federalism all the way down can be thought of as an institutional strategy for furthering the same goals that we traditionally associate with the First and 14th Amendments. It's a strategy for empowering minorities, not just oppressing them. So let me start with race. Relations between federalism and equal protection have been strained. Because of the dark history of Jim Crow, those genuinely interested in federalism often end up offering an apologetic sidebar on questions of equality. And those interested in racial justice have long been skeptical of federalism for utterly sensible historical reasons. Federalism has long been thought to be a code word for letting racists be racist, leading many to believe that parochialism is a threat to racial minorities. Parochialism, however, is a double-edged sword. The benefits of minority control can extend not just to Southern racists, but to blacks and Latinos. And yet we continue to look with suspicion upon local institutions where racial minorities dominate. Federalism is a theory that thinks about states as sites of political integration precisely because they allow national minorities to rule. So why don't we think of cities and juries and school committees as sites of racial integration precisely because they allow racial minorities to rule? Federalism all the way down, in short, suggests that those interested in racial justice should take a fresh look at federalism, and those interested in federalism may want to talk a little bit more about race. So I just want to give you a couple of examples to underscore how impoverished our vocabulary is when we discuss the values associated with minority rule once we move past the states. So here's one from the mainstream media. The New York Times recently wrote a story on Nebraska's decision to address school failures in Omaha by dividing the city into three racially identifiable districts. Every one of them contained people of every race, but one school district was predominantly white, one predominantly black, and one predominantly Latino. What made the story unusual is that the proponent of the plan was Ernie Chambers, the only African American in Nebraska's legislature and a man long known for his devotion to civil rights. Chambers proposed the plan because he wanted to let black parents control schools in their own neighborhoods. So here's the New York Times headline. Law to segregate Omaha school divides Nebraska. The Times condemned majority-minority school districts as segregated, and as if Omaha is segregating its schools, who wants to be on the wrong side of that fight? Or consider the Supreme Court's race jurisprudence. In Shaw, the court condemned majority-minority electoral districts as political apartheid. In Croson, the court, relying on the great John Hart Ely, held that minority set-aside programs were more constitutionally suspect because they had been enacted by a black majority city council. Unless you think that it's just the colorblindness camp that holds these views, let me remind you that the same majority-minority districts damned as balkanizing by the court's conservatives were termed the politics of the second best by its liberals. Or consider the terminology used by every justice in Parents Involved, the recent schools case, which condemned heterogeneous school districts as segregated because they were dominated by minorities. So setting aside for a moment the merits of these decisions, and I realize that's a big set aside, it is odd that we so quickly affix the dreaded label segregation to institutions where racial minorities dominated. Critical distinctions get lost when we cast these issues as debates about segregation versus integration. The most obvious is that these districts may be different from the homogeneous enclaves of Jim Crow. And the less obvious is that viewed through the lens of federalism, we might imagine these sites as opportunities for empowering racial minorities rather than oppressing them. Our skepticism about minority-dominated institutions runs so deep, it is inscribed in our very vocabulary. We have a firm sense of what integration or diversity looks like. We value institutions that look like the community from which they are drawn, that look like America, to use Bill Clinton's favorite phrase. We thus use the term diversity to describe decision-making bodies that are a statistical mirror of the underlying population. If blacks are 25% of the population, they should be 25% of the decision-making body. In fact, we even term institutions integrated when they contain only a token number of racial minorities. Because of the talismanic significance of Brown, we are deeply skeptical of anything that departs from that vision of integration. So you might wonder at this point why anyone would be skeptical of the notion that democratic bodies should look like America. But the oddity of this theory for empowering racial minorities is that it relentlessly reproduces the same numeric inequalities on governance bodies that racial minorities experience pretty much everywhere else. It's as if we imagine that the path of integration has to move straight from civic inclusion to full integration, and we miss the possibility that there is an intermediary stage along that path, political empowerment. I think it is possible to believe, even revere it, the life work of J. Skelly Wright, and still wonder about these questions. Civic inclusion was the hardest fight, but it turns out that discrimination is a complex monster and more resistant to change than one might think. It may require new, even unexpected tools to address it. And as a voting rights scholar, it is hard for me to see why political empowerment wouldn't be one of those tools. So you can see, of course, the relevance of federalism, which depends on, even glories in, the notion that national minorities constitute local majorities. Federalism has always been understood to be about minority rule, not homogenous enclaves. But as I said, racial minorities are not the sort of minorities that typically rule at the state level. If we can build a theory about minority governance at the state level, we can orient that theory around racial minorities governing at the local. So let me give you a partial sketch of what federalism all the way down might look like and how it connects to ongoing literatures on racial empowerment. So my claim is that minority rule, and not just minority rights, can promote the goals that have long dominated our thinking on the 14th Amendment. So I want to start with the material benefits associated with racial empowerment through local governance. Because many have argued quite idealistically that having representatives of racial minorities at the political table to lend their voice or perspective results in more enlightened laws. I believe that deeply, but I want to draw on a more muscular conception of political power. So think about Croson, where the black majority city council created a minority set-aside program only to have it struck down by the Supreme Court. The case is often invoked as an example of the court's blindness, using its formalist conception of race to ignore historical realities. If you think about the most generous read of the case, I think that read is that the case is as much about racial self-dealing as it is about racial classification. That is, you don't have to subscribe to the court's anti-essentialist view to condemn pork and patronage, the use of political access to enrich one's own community. But if we imagine cities as sites of minority empowerment, we might remember that pork and patronage have long been part of the project of integration. Consider the Lithuanian and Polish wards in Chicago, or the power that Irish and Italian political machines exercised in Boston. The link between political success and economic advancement pulled ethnic outsiders into the system. And perhaps the same is true of race. Pam Carlin and Sam Zakraff have even argued that economic progress for African Americans has turned not on the vindication of civil rights, but on business set-asides, affirmative action, and government employment. They write, "The creation of a black middle class has depended on the vigilance of a black political class." Now, promoting integration by equalizing chances to feast at the public trough may seem less attractive than a rights-based strategy, which furthers integration by removing barriers to fair competition. But the right strategy isn't entirely free of normative complications. It risks treating racial minorities as wards of the court rather than efficacious political actors in their own right. Imagining local power as a site of integration would push toward a more rough and tumble vision of equality, one that recognized the dignity in groups protecting themselves rather than looking to the courts for solace, which is a vision I think that animates much of the work at the school on social movements. Even if this competing conception of equality was not going to move the Federalist Five in Croson to endorse Justice Marshall's account of the city's action in dissent, at the very least, it should have prevented them from taking Ely's side in this debate. Now, building on Ann Phillips' observation that politics is not just about self-interest, it's also about self-image, one might also think that minority rule generates constitutive benefits that further the integrative ideal, that power and identity might be more closely tied than we typically think. So one example, one vestige of our binary understanding of racial integration, that the categories are diverse or segregated, is that there is a near absolute consensus in the United States that governing bodies should look like America. It's not a coincidence that Bill Clinton, the world's best politician, loved that phrase. We laud this vision of diversity on the ground that racial minorities offer a distinctive view or experience, and this ought to be included in the democratic decision-making process. So those who favor what is called the politics of recognition wax eloquent on the dignity associated with voice and participation. An account of integration derived from a rights-based conception of equality has only gotten us so far, however. Thus far, it's led us to a vision of statistical integration, decision-making bodies that look like America. But I think integration should mean more. It should be an aspirational term that means racial minorities are as much a part of the warp and woof of the polity as any other group. Our goal should not just be statistical mirroring or token representation, but a genuine mingling and mixing of members of different groups. We should ensure that every racial group has different scripts, to use Anthony Appiah's term. If we think of integration in these terms, I think we might begin to question whether statistical mirroring is an integrative strategy in every context. Federalism all the way down would supply grounds for criticizing this vision of minority empowerment, the one that has wholly dominated our discourse on racial equality. It would remind us that our strategy for racial empowerment doesn't just reproduce racial groups' numeric equality throughout the system, but effectively marks racial minorities as political losers whenever people divide on issues of race. The political script that we give racial minorities is to be the junior partner or the gadfly on every decision. Now, it's hard to see those costs associated with a conventional vision of equality because we don't have an account of the alternative. Without a vision of federalism all the way down, minority-dominated institutions get lumped together with segregated ones, and we fail to see why it might be useful for racial minorities to have a chance to turn the tables, to shed the role of influencer or gadfly, to stand in the shoes of the majority. Now, you might fairly point out that racial minorities are numeric minorities, and numeric minorities are supposed to lose in a democracy. But that seems to me it's precisely why a federalist perspective matters here. Federalism is a theory about why democracy can work better when the usual losers sometimes win and the usual winners sometimes lose. Moreover, in a world of lumpy residential patterns and statistical blips, ours is a world of federalism all the way down, in which decision-making bodies of every sort, districts and school committees and city councils and juries, are dominated by groups of every sort, Irish and Catholics, Greens and Libertarians. We don't worry about this representational kaleidoscope, let alone term it segregated, merely because one group or another is taking its turn standing in for the whole. And it seems to me the true integration would mean that the same is true when racial minorities form part of that kaleidoscope. So let me ground this with an example, and here I'm going to return to the most controversial one, public schools, where I think making the case for federalism all the way down is the most challenging because of the sordid history of Jim Crow. I think if it's possible to make even a remotely plausible case here, then it's possible to make a stronger case elsewhere in the system. So think back to the New York Times condemnation of Ernie Chambers. Our discomfort with his approach plainly stems from Brown. But it also stems from the fact that we don't imagine local institutions playing the same role that states play in knitting together a national polity. So just put yourselves in the shoes of Omaha's black residents for just a minute. Statewide, their population is so small that they can elect only a single black legislator. If every decision-making body looked like Nebraska, African Americans would always be the junior partner to any decision. The Omaha plan, in contrast, turns the tables. It would allow blacks and Latinos to enjoy the same sense of efficacy and deal with the same kinds of problems as the usual members of the majority. They would have an opportunity to forge consensus and to fend off dissenters, to get something done and to compromise more than they'd like. If the politics of recognition scholars are right, that granting voice represents an acknowledgement of equal status, federalism all the way down acknowledges the ability of racial minorities not just to participate, but to rule. In place of the politics of presence, we might have the politics of power. So the benefits of turning the tables are not, of course, confined to racial minorities. If we want to move to a Dahlian world of fluid coalitional politics, it might be useful to denormalize whites' political experiences, depriving them of the comfort and power typically associated with their majority status. Everyone, to borrow a phrase from President George W. Bush, ought to experience a good thumping. Now, pulling these ideas together, we might ask whether Ernie Chambers' faith in majority-minority school districts is as foolish as the New York Times would have us think. Chambers obviously thinks that governance matters to the long-term project of integration. Now, while the conventional view of school integration is that the interactions that really matter are those inside the classroom, not the PTA, it doesn't require all that much imagination to think of reasons why Chambers might have a point. If parental commitment matters to school quality, it may be that Black and Latino parents would feel more committed to a school where they enjoy the same power to govern, the same level of control that is routinely exercised by white parents. Moreover, such districts would make visible the fact that representatives of the Black and Latino community are not just representing their own racial groups, but governing for the entire district. Political discourse would include at least some of the usual stuff of school politics: building, budgeting, benchmarking. These are issues on which both whites and racial minorities can unite and divide. And if we were just a little bit more imaginative, we might even think of Chambers' project as promoting integration of a different sort. Because if we took a bird's eye view of Nebraska, we would see a kaleidoscope, with majority white and majority Black and majority Latino communities being represented by the school systems they created rather than the legislators that they elected. The people would be represented by their decisions, not other people. Now, I don't want to venture a guess as to the right answer to these questions, nor make the silly claim that this set of values trumps all others. Turning the tables in school governance may well undermine more important, more conventional integrative efforts, like equalizing funding. It may be that because of the overlay of socioeconomic conditions or the prevalence of racial discrimination or just the ways in which kids interact in school, statistical integration is the right path to genuine integration in this context. My point is not that I know how the debate should end. My point is that we should simply start having it. Finally, just as local institutions can be thought of as a site for empowering racial minorities, so too with dissenters, who also tend to be too small to control at the state level. When dissenters constitute local majorities, they can dissent by deciding, enacting a real-life version of their view. They can speak truth with power rather than just to it. And if you walk through the major justifications offered for caring about the First Amendment, the marketplace of ideas, facilitating best self-expression, you can imagine ways in which dissenting by deciding furthers the same goals. Now, federalism scholars do sometimes talk about states' roles as dissenters, but a lot of them tend to play down its rebellious possibilities. And that's not surprising. The policymaking power that states enjoy allows them to challenge, thwart, even defy the decisions of the national majority. And that's an uncomfortable fact for federalism, because sovereignty would shield such decisions, no matter how abhorrent, from reversal. But federalism all the way down may offer a more attractive model for dissenting by deciding, because it allows the national majority to reverse a decision if it is willing to spend the political capital to do so. Freed from the heavy costs associated with sovereignty, we might be able to focus on the reasons to celebrate the principal-agent problem rather than apologize for it, to make the case that maybe the principal-agent problem isn't always a problem. Because while dissenting by deciding clearly has its costs, it does give state and local institutions the power to set the agenda, to force majority engagement, to generate deliberative froth. Free speech has long been thought of as the right channel for dissent, but the right to speak freely is not always enough to force the majority to engage. After all, a well-advised majority might think that the safest course is just to ignore the dissenters, not to engage, radio silence. Just think about sort of our universal image of someone exercising his free speech rights. It's someone standing up on a soapbox. And I don't know if you've ever been in the square watching someone on a soapbox. The majority just walks on by. If you want to set the agenda, issuing a decision that thwarts the governing majority's will is a pretty good way to force the majority to engage. Just ask San Francisco, whose decision to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples prompted such a furor. Precisely because decisions impose externalities that speech generally does not, dissenters can at least push the majority to take the steps necessary to reverse them. And efforts at reversal generally require some engagement. Agenda-setting power, in short, may be the most powerful weapon that dissenters can possess. And that's precisely what federalism all the way down gives them. And here I just want to note one connection between what I talked about in the first half of the talk and this last point. I want to talk about the relationship between this point and the role of the power of the servant, the idea that political integration and independence play an important part of this project. So just think for a minute about the difference between San Francisco's decision to issue licenses to same-sex couples and Massachusetts' decision to do so. They were rendered at roughly the same time. Massachusetts' decision was protected by sovereignty. It was shielded from reversal. Indeed, consistent with the sovereignist view, Massachusetts even tried to confine the effects of its decision to its own territory by limiting licenses only to state residents. San Francisco, in contrast, took advantage of our mutual interdependence and married anyone who made the trip. Rosie O'Donnell flew from New York to get married. And that forced state attorneys general and governors, who had been working very hard not to take any positions on this issue, to have to decide whether those marriages counted. Sovereignty protected Massachusetts' decision from reversal, and that gave Massachusetts the power to continue with the experiment, to continue giving us a real-life instantiation of its views. But I can't help think that even though San Francisco has been reversed and reversed and reversed, it has had more of an effect on this debate, precisely because it is integrated into a larger system and has forced the majority to engage with it rather than to ignore it. Who knows whether in the end Massachusetts is going to look like that solitary dissenter on the soapbox, precisely because it is outside the system and cannot be reversed. Whereas San Francisco, playing the servant's role, may do more to shape this debate in the long run. Now, if you think that the political system has a sufficient amount of debate and deliberative froth, there is little point in giving dissenters the power to set the agenda. But if you think that the democratic system is locked up, that issues don't get heard because elites have no interest in debating them, think about immigration or election reform or gay rights, you might think federalism all the way down has its attractions. Minority rule at the local level is one strategy for generating democratic churn, the friction necessary for an ossified system to move forward. And so here I will close by returning to the claim with which I began. When you read the federalism literature, what is remarkable is how little has changed during the last decade. With some noteworthy exceptions, the field remains dominated by the same arguments, which are often just rewound around new doctrinal developments that the Supreme Court offers us. Despite arguments that those who care about federalism should move beyond states and beyond sovereignty, even those making the arguments haven't fully done so. And that might lead you to think that we've said the last word on federalism. But if I can leave you with one possible idea today, I hope it is this, that there's more to say about federalism. Thank you.